Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. The experience with Now was another talk, and what I wanted to the title here, Spinning Heads and Spinning News, was kind of a play on the fact that mathematics tends to terrify people, and a lot of people feel like their heads are spinning whenever you actually talk about anything of mathematical content. However, the media talks about statistics all the time and often does a good job and often does a bad job, and it's often used to spin news. So I thought it was appropriate also for a DC audience to come at it from this point of view. I wanted to just take a word to say something about my own research. So as Michael said, I actually do work in group actions on manifolds and complex geometry, which is very theoretical mathematics. And I call that at sort of being in the ivory tower. It's where most people who are professors of mathematics begin their careers in college, and we just never leave. But I have to say that I've never felt it was quite enough for me. I've always also been interested in Main Street, which is to say, how does mathematics affect daily life for most people who have nothing to do with the university? And that's why I started working with this organization called STAT. And this is a nonprofit organization that became affiliated with George Mason in 2004. And that's when I joined the organization as the director of research. It's a very small-run organization. There's an editor, Trevor Butterworth, and then we have a couple of interns, and we have a couple of kind of professional writers who work for us. But it's a very small organization, and it's a very interesting organization. And what we do is we take a critical look at the news. And, of course, as many of you know, there's a lot of topics that use statistics in the news. Some of them are up here on the board. Economics and money, crime, social behavior. The budget, of course, has become a big one now, as has all of the financial stuff on Wall Street. And sports, and then polls and opinion, public health and healthcare and education. And I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about these last three in this talk, but I really want to emphasize that some of the themes that come up here are really themes that go across a lot of different disciplines in terms of what you're actually writing about. It's more how you actually write about it. So here's a list of common misunderstandings that you see in the press all the time, and some of you will recognize them, and I just want to take a couple moments to explain some of them. So, first of all, what the press often gets wrong is what the meaning of statistically significant is. And this is a really important concept in statistics. Whenever you run a test that has some kind of statistics behind it, you've got a certain amount of chance that you'll find something that wasn't there, or that you won't find something that really was there. And so there's this measure of how likely it is that what you found is really there. And that's what statistical significance is. So, for example, you could measure, suppose somebody is flipping their coin, and flipping coins is going to come up later in this talk as well. Somebody's flipping a coin and they got 10 heads. And you see, wow, that's really amazing. And you want to know how likely is the coin to be biased. So you might do some sort of statistical test, like how likely would it be that I would flip a coin 10 times and get the same result? And that would tell you whether your result was statistically significant or not. And in that case, it's very unlikely to get 10 heads. So if you did, there might be something behind it, like a biased coin. And so if you're checking about whether something causes cancer, and you try to look at the rates of cancer among people who are exposed to some toxic chemical versus people who aren't, you want to measure how likely would you see these responses just due to chance alone, and how likely would it be due to some other cause. So that's why statistical significance is really important. Causation versus correlation. This is also something that comes up all the time. And so to give you a real simple example of the difference between causation and correlation, I saw an article last year which is all about how women who do yoga have a better body image than women who don't do yoga. And it was suggested by the article that we could combat problems of women having poor body image and then having an assortment of problems like bulimia by giving yoga classes. And, you know, maybe that would really help women, or maybe it's just that women who have a body image are also more likely to do yoga for other reasons. So that's the difference between causing something, that whether not doing yoga could cause poor body image, or correlation. And you see this all the time. Women with eating disorders watch more soap operas. Women with eating disorders have this attribute or that attribute. Are these correlated things, or are they causal? And it's really, it's surprising how many times they're interpreted to be causal. Relative risk versus absolute risk. This is also one that comes up a lot. If your absolute risk of something is really small and your relative risk is really high, guess what gets reported in the press? Always your relative risk. So I like to say the example that my absolute risk of a piano falling on my head as I walk to work is extraordinarily small. But my relative risk if I walk versus if I drive is very high. Okay? So this is when you point out if the absolute risk is very low, even a high relative risk might not be important. On the other hand, if your absolute risk is high, even a small change in relative risk could mean a lot. So it's really important to understand that. Let me skip odds ratio versus relative risk. Confounding factors is a really important one. If you want to conclude something about, let's suppose, again, we're talking about cancer rates, and we say, okay, say people who are obese are more likely to suffer from, let's say heart disease, not cancer, from heart disease, what kind of confounding factors will you have to consider? Well, there are a lot of things that are correlated with obesity and are also correlated with heart disease. For example, poverty. So how do you control for those confounding factors and say the problem is really poverty or the problem is really obesity or something like that? So these kinds of things come up all the time, and people who are serious about doing research about health things in our lives are very careful about their confounding factors, and sometimes they're less careful than you think, and sometimes actually a confounding factor might come back to bite you. We're going to see later on about smoking being a confounding factor in research on the difference between nursing or using infant formula, mothers smoking with their infants around, and sometimes the science doesn't think this will be a confounding factor, and it later turns out to be really important. Scales and order of magnitude, this is another one. Sometimes a small problem is reported as a big problem, and or you just have large numbers thrown at you, like, you know, exposures of 7 micrograms, is that a lot or little? You know, and people have a hard time understanding how much is a microgram, how much is a milligram, how do these compare to each other? And I think also journalists have sometimes trouble with that. Margin of error is another one that comes up a lot. We're going to talk a lot about margin of error, so let me just skip over that for now. And then this last one is something I like to emphasize a lot. What's the consensus of scientists versus individual research results? And the reason I bring this up is because a lot of reporting is done because somebody did a new study on something, and they want to get press about it. There's a new study that says that caffeine causes miscarriage among pregnant women. So, you know, that's what's reported, and it's not reported. There's a whole body of research on this, and there's a consensus about it among scientists who actually study the question of caffeine and miscarriage rates. And I think that this is one of the things that press often misses. What's the consensus of the scientists versus what's one person's individual research, because science is often built on hundreds and hundreds of people's research. So let me just give you an example, because examples always really make it very real for people. This is an example last year from the Associated Press, in which a probe found drugs in drinking water. So these are all quotes from the Associated Press article on it. A vast array of pharmaceuticals, including antibiotics, anticonvulsants, mood stabilizers, and sex hormones have been found in the drinking water supplies of at least 41 million Americans. Officials in Philadelphia said testing there discovered 56 pharmaceuticals or byproducts in treated drinking water, including medicines for pain, infection, high cholesterol, asthma, epilepsy, mental illness, and heart problems. 63 pharmaceuticals or byproducts were found in the city's watershed. Anti-epileptic and anti-anxiety medications were detected in a portion of the drinking water for 18.5 million people in Southern California. Researchers at the U.S. Geological Survey analyzed a Passaic Valley Water Commission drinking water treatment plant, which served 850,000 people in northern New Jersey, and found a metabolized angina medicine and the mood stabilizing carbamazepine in drinking water. Three medications, including an antibiotic, were found in drinking water supplies to Tucson, Arizona. So you can see how this list goes. A sex hormone was detected in San Francisco. And then we've got, of course, the local story, the drinking water for D.C. and surrounded areas tested positive for six pharmaceuticals. So what wasn't said in this article, which gave a whole list of rather scary things that might be in our drinking water, and I was about to go buy bottled water. First of all, there's no discussion of Orders Magazine. Actually, I shouldn't say there's none. There was a comment that drugs were found in concentrations ranging from parts per billion to parts per trillion, which is sort of like saying something costs between $1,000 and $1 million. It gives us no information. The range is really huge. And so we don't know. What does that mean? What's the effect of having these drugs exposure in minute quantities? I mean, I have no idea whether it's a problem that I would be exposed to low levels of pharmaceuticals or not. And I should point out that there are things like arsenic is in carrots. And nobody is talking about how dangerous carrots are because it's there in very minute quantities. So it's really important to talk about that. And again, what about comparisons to other contaminants that we know are in drinking water? Like the water comes from treated sewage. So I just want to kind of point out that the message here of the AP reporting is get worried, this is terrible, drugs are bad, and you should be scared. And by the way, for those of you who buy bottled drinking water, there was a recent flurry of news about how there are a lot of contaminants inside of bottled drinking water. So I think it really drives home the point that talking about these in quantities that you can actually say this is what it means is really, really important. Just putting a list of some kind of existence of contaminants, I think, is much less convincing than knowing something about them. So now what I want to do is tell you, for me, when I joined this organization, at first I just saw a lot of cute stories like that AP probe thing, and I didn't really care all that much in any deep personal way, but at a certain point it became sort of personal for me. I had had a kid, and then I found this advertisement, and I want to talk about all.
Show babies who are breastfed are less likely to develop ear infections, respiratory illnesses, and diarrhea. Babies were born to be breastfed.
So the point is that film, as you saw, was a woman riding a bull, and a very pregnant woman riding a bull and falling off. And the message was, you wouldn't take risks before you had your baby. Why would you take risks after? And this was put out by the Department of Health and Human Services, which is a branch. Which is the overseeing organization for the National Institutes of Health. So the message there is not breastfeeding is dangerous. So this is me and my little baby at the time. He's now 18 months. And so the question is it dangerous to use infant formula? And at that time, there was a big New York Times article, which was entitled, and it was related to that advertisement you just saw, Breastfeed or Else. And it had a teaser in large letters warning public health officials have determined that not breastfeeding may be hazardous to your baby's health. So this became, a lot of people asked me, were you nursing? And actually I was nursing, but I still was very offended by this, as maybe many of you are here, as a sort of, you know, how dangerous is it to use infant formula? And let me just express how extreme they were about their point of view. The lead scientist on this study that talked about how dangerous it was is quoted saying, just like it's risky to smoke during pregnancy, it's risky not to breastfeed after. They're really driving home the point that women should be breastfeeding. And then they made a lot of claims in the article. Breastfeeding reduces risk for ear infections and flu, which is actually fairly uncontroversially true, but also for obesity, diabetes, sudden infant death syndrome, asthma, and leukemia, all of which are very controversial and not agreed upon in the community. And it also noted that IQ rates increase with nursing, which turned out to be absolutely false. And this is a good example of when a confounding factor is controlled for. The study that supported this point of view forgot to control for the mother's IQ. And when they did, they found that nursing didn't have an impact on IQ. So is it dangerous to use? Well, it turns out smoking is much more dangerous than not nursing. And the studies on nursing as a whole, we looked at a tremendous amount of research in coming to our conclusions and stats, and it was extremely poorly done. I mean, you can imagine why it's hard. It's very hard to do randomized trials on this. You can't say, let's take two groups of women and tell one that they have to nurse and the other that they have to use formula and then see what happens. So you're really just looking at observational data, and it makes it very hard to control for all the confounders. It's very hard to do this kind of research. So the attempts are laudable, but the research was poorly done. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of confounding factors that this research has been going on for like 40 years. So you've got things that people didn't used to think was important, like that the parents smoked at home. And then they'd say, oh, look, children who are on infant formula also have asthma. Well, it turns out that that was actually due to the smoking, which is much more believable. So these kinds of things, but yet the research is still cited, and it's still used, and it's still included as part of the body of literature about it. So you have to be very careful as to how these conclusions are done. There's also important issues of demographics. You know, third world countries versus first world countries have very different water quality. And what's the magnitude of the benefit? And this is what I was saying before. Let's talk about this in a quantitative way. If you take it at face value and you believe the most aggressive assessments of risk of something that causes death, like leukemia, not in all cases does leukemia cause death, but it's certainly a very sad thing, and you attribute all of that to not nursing, the risk is less than the risk of driving with an infant in the car with a car seat. Okay, so this is not zero risk. This is low risk. I have never been to a pediatrician who's told me, don't get in your car. Never. Okay, so this is, and I really want to emphasize, it's really important to understand the magnitude of the benefit, because if you are somebody who's trying to decide whether or not to nurse, you have a lot of things to balance. And this might be one of them. Maybe you should walk instead of driving. So human side, which is that there's a no negative side to the coverage. So you really have to think that bad science has consequences. And this is part of the thing I want to emphasize on this. So I just want to take a moment to give a little statistics course here. And this is the only statistics that I'm really going to talk about here. But I want to talk about the normal curve, because this is something that's really, really important in so many concepts that get presented in the press. So I want to just assume that I have for a moment, I'm going to tell you what this chart represents, but I have something that I want to measure. And the true value of the measurement is this value here, which I'm calling mu, just for the sake of this conversation. So the normal curve says, well, I can't really get mu because I can't check everybody. What I can do is check a sample of people. So for example, I can say, well, there's a certain percentage of people who support Obama, and there are a certain percentage that support McCain. Let's just say, well, I want to know about the Obama supporters. And I want to know what is mu? What's the true percentage in the population? Well, I can't ask everybody. So what I can do is I can take a sample of people and say, well, in my sample, what's the percentage? And what the curve tells you is, if I take samples, what percentage I'm likely to get. Okay? So what you should imagine here is on the x-axis here along the horizontal axis, you're getting a sense of what the value is of the measurement in the sample. And so I might get higher or lower than you. And along the y-axis, what I have is a likelihood of my getting that measurement. So what I want to emphasize here is that the most likely scenario is that I'll get some value kind of near mu. And what sigma is telling me, sigma is what's called a standard deviation, and sigma tells me how far out I have to go to capture a certain amount of the data. And so it's sort of like saying that, so if I add these two numbers up, I get 68.2%, so I'm 68.2% likely to get within one standard deviation of the value mu. And this is a really important concept. The likelihood that I would get far away from the mean So in the yellow region is 2.15% on one side and 2.15% on the other, if I ask for two standard deviations. What's done in a lot of epidemiological things is we talk about having 95% certainty. And 95% is actually 1.96 standard deviations out. So it's a little bit here. So you've got 2.5% to one side, and a little bit left up here is 2.5% chance of getting here. So that's the chance, so 5% chance is that you would get outside of 1.96 standard deviations from the mean. And this is a really important concept because if you assume that things behave in a nice way, then what you're going to find is that you're most likely to sample something near the mean. And that's a really important principle in statistics, so that when you are doing some kind of research and you find some sort of result, you want to know how likely it's going to be due to chance. You're going to look at these kinds of normal curves. And when you talk about polling, you're going to involve normal curves, and I'm going to bring that up later on. But this curve is never mentioned in any newspaper articles, but they'll use it a lot. They use it a lot, but they often use it to spin things. And that's what I think happened with some of the stuff on nursing. But let me give you another example of the kind of spin. Actually, let me just point out first that what we've seen is that there's a lot of politics in science. So that science, we ask, you know, when I started this work, I really came at it from the point of view that science is true. And, you know, there's this question, can we actually look for truth? Because we have a lot of bias in how we interpret things, and everything really goes along a continuum, not so black and white. Is science pure? And does morality or our convictions drive our research? And you'd be amazed, but when you think about heated topics like nursing, like abortion, like anything that people really care about passionately, you will find that the science by the scientists is not so pure. Okay, so now then you have that the media is going to take that and do with it what it will. So it becomes a very complicated process, and one in which the people whose voice is loudest is heard the most. And I always get this question, where does your funding come from, they ask me. But there's important questions about where funding comes from whenever you start looking at issues of science. And it just shows just how much politics really are included in science. Let me give you another example.
I thought I'd live forever. I was dumbfounded when the doctor told me I have late-stage colon cancer.
Deciding between surgery and radiation wasn't easy. Who knows what sort of side effects I'll have? It's been really tough on my husband, my kids, and me. Cancer affects the whole family.
Cancer risk starts early. Even small amounts of processed meats can lead to adult cancers.
Okay, so that was sponsored by the cancerproject.org, which was actually it was actually paid for by a group of physicians, and CNN did a report on this. They pointed out that the ad was sponsored by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, so these are doctors, and they noted this was an animal rights group that wants us all to be vegans. And I only point out that they said this to suggest that the organization was not as mainstream as other doctors' organizations. However, with that caveat, they went on to affirm the link between processed meats, nitrates in particular, and cancer. And they cited research from the American Institute for Cancer and the American Cancer Society. And they said outright that one hot dog a day causes an increase by 21% in cancer. So I'm really in trouble. So what didn't they report? And I, by the way, am not trying to say that this is an incorrect point of view. What I really want to point out is how the reporting itself can really lack a wholeness to it, that they're not talking about consensus anymore. They're talking about what one organization and a small one believes. And in particular, the American Medical Association, which is much more mainstream and much larger than the Association for Responsible Physicians, I'm sure I said their name wrong, They did a literature review, and they found that the epidemiological studies cannot confirm any association between the presence of nitrates or nitrites in food and the formation of NOCs and the causation of human cancer. So this was a really significant finding, which at least would think would merit mention in a CNN coverage where millions of people are watching. And the AMA also published a letter in the New York Times dismissing the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and saying their tactics were unethical. They had a history, apparently, of doing some other unsavory advertisements. And it turns out, for those of you who are interested, that this cancer process meat link has not been shown to be statistically significant. There's a lot of confounding factors, particularly recall bias, which is to say that people who get cancer tend to paint a pretty ugly picture of what they did. You know, I'm guilty. I ate a hot dog. So after we start asking about whether there are politics in science, you might start wondering whether there's any science in politics. And I would say, unfortunately, there's very little science in politics. But I did want to kind of mention one very politically charged case, which came from evaluations of deaths in the during the Iraq War. And I'm just going to mention one of the studies about this, which was in 2004. And this was a study published in Lancet, which is a fairly respectable British journal, reporting that 98,000 excess Iraqi deaths occurred. And then they stated that the error margin was 8,000 to 196,000. Now, a lot of you are laughing, and I do want to point out what the media response to it was, which maybe corresponds to some of your chuckles, that it was just as likely to be 8,000 as it was to be 98,000. Now, of course, you all know the normal curve. And a statement of error to say the error margin was 8,000 to 196,000, the statisticians were trying to prove there were more deaths since the U.S.-led invasion than there had been previously. They weren't actually trying to quantify it. So once you know that there were more, they want to find a 95% confidence interval. So they sampled people, and then they made a prediction of what that would mean about the whole population. And so the 95% confidence interval is somewhere in this range. And the most likely value, likelihood is along the y-axis, is that it's going to be around 98,000. So it's not true that it's just as likely to be 8,000. Now, you could question some of the techniques, and a lot of people did, and this was a very interesting and very long conversation. And what we had with politicians getting in the world of statistics here, Bush called the methods controversial, and they were fairly standard methods in epidemiology. And press picked up on that word, and things went from there. And this is one of these kinds of issues where you see people being less than scientifically honest on both sides of this fence, and you really have people who are opposed to the war touting these numbers, and people who are in favor of the war who pointed out all the problems with the sampling techniques. And that was actually in marked contrast to what happened in, say, the Vietnam War, where people who were pro-war wanted to tout how many communists were killed. And so here, people who were pro-war were trying to diminish these results. So that's kind of an interesting place in which politics really and science, sort of came together. And I wanted to say there are a lot of political actions that are based on science, and I'm just going to mention a couple others that have come up recently. These aren't necessarily the best ones, but just some that I noticed. There's been a move to ban phthalates as a class of chemicals from toys. This is made, I think it's now in the level of national legislation. These are laws passed in California not to allow phthalates in toys. And it turns out that there's no evidence that the route of exposure is actually through toys of phthalates. It turns out dust and food are our greatest exposure to these chemicals. Educational programs, which are designed based on poor data. No Child Left Behind is a good example of this, and I'm actually going to bring that up in a little bit of some other things that are based on No Child Left Behind data. And recommendations for alcohol consumption for pregnant nursing women is another example where there's a lot of political action based on very little science. So, great. So now what I want to do here is say a little bit more about the No Child Left Behind educational stuff. Not so much No Child Left Behind itself, which is another conversation, but to talk a little bit about education and to get a little metaphysical here and to talk about math education, since this is the MAA. So there's been some recent news in the press, which some of you may have followed, coming from the National Science Foundation that did a study pointing to how girls have caught up to boys in mathematics. And this claim was largely based on the No Child Left Behind data. So what they did was they requested data from all 50 states. They got responses from 10 states to give them the data. That's pretty good, actually. It's not terrible. It turns out that data was comparable to what national averages were about what boys and girls did. And they even got the data broken up by race and other things as well. So it was very interesting kind of data, and they could compare boys and girls and get some information that hadn't been got before. And what they found was that the averages of girls and the averages of boys had gotten very close together, which it hadn't been before. And this was coming off of remarks made in 2005 by the president of Harvard, who said that women may lack as much intrinsic aptitude as men in science and math. And this was actually said in the context of why there aren't women who are tenured in math and science at Harvard University. And so he wasn't actually talking about average women and average men. And this is one of the things I think the press really misunderstood. He was talking about variation. He was talking about who scores really, really, really high, far from the mean. So let me give you a picture of what Summers was talking about. These are two normal curves. And what you're supposed to imagine here, remember that you should think of this as like the middle score here. That's the average score that someone might get. And the greenish curve here is supposed to be what boys do, meaning that boys are really spread out in their performance on tests. And girls, they all tend to score kind of near the mean. This is Summers' argument. And so what you see here is that if you're only interested in hiring those people who are the best at math, you'd cut off maybe here, and you would find there aren't any girls. And so this is what he was trying to say. He wasn't really saying there aren't any girls. He was saying that there are very few. So that girls and boys may have the exact same average, but still what you're seeing is a very different standard deviation and a very different interpretation far from the mean. You're going to see many more boys than girls. That was his argument, and that was based on the SAT test. Now, I don't have the data for SAT tests, but I want to talk for a moment about the response. Many academics, including myself, were pretty outraged by the comments. And I would only point out that Summers spoke from a history of sexism, in particular at Harvard, and it echoed comments made about blacks in the past, also at Harvard. And it turns out that there's not a very strong correlation between SAT scores, which is what he was talking about, and winning tenure at Harvard. Okay? So this is the important thing. What are the data actually going to tell you if he's trying to make an interpretation about getting tenure at Harvard? So, but what was the press response to not so much Larry Summers' comments, but to the academic outrage about Larry Summers' comments? They declared academic freedom and free speech is dead because he should have a right to say what he wants to say. That was the argument, without the comment that free speech means that you should, and especially in the context of academia, is that you should be subject to the standards of academia, meaning the standards of academic research. His comments were not really what people who do research in the field of math education or science education would have said. So what else did the press do? They wrote a lot of interesting articles about the biological differences in the brain between males and females. And not a whole lot is known about how to interpret those biological differences in terms of how are they going to pan out, how are they going to express themselves. They interviewed teachers at magnet schools to say, what's your story? Are there girls in your class? And then here's a good one. They poked fun at themselves for their own innumeracy. You know, like you get an article that starts, well, I have trouble balancing my checkbook, chuckle, chuckle. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, would it be funny if we made fun of ourselves if we didn't know how to read? I mean, it's this was a very typical kind of press response. Recent press response following NSF results was to declare that the gap has closed between boys and girls. And, of course, they just talk about the averages when the press talks about it, but there is an interesting question about what happened far from the mean. And I just thought I would tell you what happened. So if you look at the 99th percentile on this data, as I said, it came from No Child Left Behind, you found that they did find some differences. And among whites, boys did better. But among Asians, girls did better. And there wasn't enough data of people in the 99th percentile for other reasons. So this makes a very interesting point that gender plays less of a role than some social factors. And this is also something that's been confirmed by other international tests. The PISA test was administered to some 30 countries and found that in some countries like Iceland, girls did a lot better than boys. And so you find these variations that are far stronger, you can make these they're stronger observations among different cultures than there are between genders. And let me just leave it at that. So let me point out another thing about this, that they actually coded the questions on the test by level of difficulty, because what they wanted to get at was, well, maybe there's big differences between boys and girls on the hard questions. And so they leveled them level one, which is like just recall facts. Level two would be a skill, like, you know, do some kind of multiplication or apply a concept. Level three was strategic thinking, and level four was extended thinking. Now, those of you who aren't even academics here might know what is required to be a scientist at a university or at a high level within a company, or to be a mathematician is clearly level three and level four, extremely important. And would have better predictive effects than, say, recall and skill. And it turns out there were so few questions on level three or level four on any of the MCLD exams that they couldn't even evaluate the differences between boys and girls. They simply didn't have enough data. So that's kind of a scary thing. The No Child Left Behind is only testing really low-level skills. And so we're still left with this question of what's going on. So what I think here is that the media are mistaking the data for something more difficult to measure. So you can only conclude what the data can accurately measure. This is a really important point. If you're going to measure something, like a test measuring recall and skills and concepts, you will end up with a result that tells you something about skills and recall in the context of a high-pressure, high-stakes, short-timed test. And is that what it takes to do advanced mathematics? And what can we tell about behavior far from the mean on these tests? And the answer, in my opinion, is not very much. And I think this is a really important point. We spend a lot of time collecting data and analyzing data, and sometimes the answer really isn't in the data. Okay, so at this point, I want to take, I will skip over some of the things that I did involved in this. I'll only say that I really was glad to be at Stats when all this stuff about Summers came out, because I had an opportunity to talk in several venues about the question of what math education experts are saying on the issue, about how well SATs will actually predict success, and about how difficult it is to make conclusions about advanced reasoning skills based on these time tests. And I felt I really made a difference in people's lives, and I really think that's what this is all about. So now let's get to what's on everybody's mind. Predicting the presidency. So let me start with polling, and again, I'm just going to give a little example of something I saw in the media. This was a poll last week. Things have changed since then. Mason-Dixon poll found Obama was ahead of McCain by 2 percentage points. and the margin of error was 4 percentage points. So there was this question, how do you report this? So some media reports say the two are head-to-head, and others say, no, Obama really is ahead. And, you know, from a statistical point of view, if you ask a statistician, she would probably pause and say, I don't know how to answer that, because if you try to look at the statistics, the likelihood that you would get that kind of outcome is that, well, 69% likely Obama's ahead. Okay? And this kind of thing is just a back-of-the-envelope calculation you get by using what's called a standard normalization table. And it just is one of these normal curves in which you try to find how likely it is you would get this kind of result, given this margin of error is telling you where the 95% confidence interval is. All right, so we need to say there are a lot of problems with polls. First of all, who are those people who don't know what they're going to vote? How do you figure out who the likely voters are? Some people have said you got to take people who've already voted, and then that would exclude most of those of you who are in the room who are 18 or above. And, and you know, in other words, there are a lot of people who have just registered to vote who are under 22 or who plan to vote this time because they're really charged. People with cell phones are not typically polled. There's this margin of sampling error, and that basically says that the more people you poll, the more likely you are to get an accurate response. The more people you poll, the more expensive your poll is to do. So we get large sampling errors sometimes. Sometimes the question can be biased. And you might say, well, how could it be biased when it comes to a poll? Well, sometimes the bias could be who's calling you up. You know, Washington Post did a poll. Well, some people don't like the Washington Post, so maybe they're not going to answer. And maybe that person tends to be more a McCain supporter than an Obama supporter. Or maybe the question says, who would you vote for? And if you say, I'm not sure, say, well, who are you leaning towards? That's a different sort of poll than the one that says, who would you vote for? And if you say you don't know, they say, okay, thank you. Okay, so there's bias in the questions. There's no uniform system for voting. So even if you know what people would want to do, that doesn't mean that they will actually do it. And which votes will count? Nobody will forget about the hanging chads in Florida. So then there's the question of people being truthful. If you call them up, are they telling you what they're really going to do? And so Bradley effect is something that's been talked about a bit, which is this became famous for a particular competition in which Bradley, who was black, was running for an office, and he had a much less strong showing in the actual vote than he did in the polls, and that may speak to the fact that people are not being truthful when they're polled. And of course, unexpected occurrences could skew everything. So we have to turn to other methods for predicting the presidency. Psychics. I found a lot of them online who would tell me, well, I got a lot of different opinions as to how the stars were aligned. And to be a little bit more serious, I got a lot of people who are really talking about how the stock market could predict it. If the stock market is doing well, then you'll see the incumbent reelected, this kind of thing. Inflation rates. Growth of the economy could determine who's going to be the president. Good news, that determines who's going to be the president. Vote by kids. Now, this is one that is run by Scholastic. I'm sure I'm getting the name of the organization wrong. Scholastic. So anyway, they run a vote every 4 years in which kids get to vote, and you get a lot of votes for Mickey Mouse, but you also get a lot of votes for the two candidates. This has been a good predictor in the past. What divorce women feel. I always love this when the press writes, some particular group of people is going to determine the election. So for this particular election that's coming up, you get a lot about what divorce women will feel, what black people feel, what young people feel. And so there are sort of different demographics that you could dice this up. And of course, they never acknowledge that nobody is going to get voted to be president without tremendous support from all groups of people, with very few exceptions. Social web data, this is sort of interesting. How many people are talking about Obama versus McCain online? That's going to predict it. Polls, of course, pundits, so, you know, these really smart guys who get paid to write for the Washington Post, New York Times, and such. regression analysis. Now, this is kind of a whole field of its own, and it's something that at universities has become really popular. And the idea here is that you put in a few coefficients. Maybe one represents inflation rates or unemployment rates or the stock market values. And then you let the numbers sort of vary around and see which is the best one. And so what you get is a great predictor for past election results. And the question is, you know, how well are they going to predict future ones? And I'll tell you about my favorite predictor. It's my magic coin. So let me tell you about my magic coin. All right. It's very simple. I flip it. If it's heads, we're Republican. If it's tails, it's Democrat. So I haven't gotten very many chuckles here, but you should be chuckling. It seems a rather an absurdity that a coin would predict a presidency. But I'm going to tell you about my coin. It's such a great coin. It's worked for the previous 15 out of 17 elections. That's a pretty impressive, impressive result. And, you know, you can work out what's the likelihood that I would have been right that many times, 15 out of the past 17 times. And it's a really small percent, just above 1%, 0.1%, that by chance. So you might be starting to be convinced that my coin has something to offer you about the upcoming election. Now let me tell you how I found it. I walked into this room where there are about 1,000 people, and they each had a coin. And they had a list of the past 17 presidents. And for the first president, they flipped their coin, and they wrote heads or tails next to number of the first president. And then they did this 17 times, and they wrote their heads and their tails down. And when they were done, I said, who got the best answer? And it turned out there was one who had gotten 15 out of the 17 past presidencies correct. That's how I found my coin. So now, it turns out there's about a 70% chance that I'd find a magic coin like that. Okay, so the 0.1%, you know, is no longer an issue now that you know how I actually found my coin. It wasn't just in the street. So then there's this question, what does this say about regression analysis? Now remember, regression analysis, the idea was that you have a lot of coefficients based on important data, like how the stock market's going, the unemployment rates, maybe what that kid's vote is. That came in a week and a half ago, and they voted for Obama. And so anyway, you could put all sorts of possible coefficients in here, and you can change them in all sorts of ways to try to minimize your error. In fact, these regression analyses are very interesting because they even predict the percentages that will vote for each candidate. And their accuracy is about right there, but they can actually do a little bit better than my magic coin. But I kind of wanted to point this out because one of the things that you see very frequently with statistics is people forget about the idea of large numbers. And they forget that if you do one test, you can see all sorts of things that may not be true if you do many tests. And if you have something that's a surefire thing like a magic coin, maybe it wasn't so magic how I found it. Maybe there's actually some statistics behind that. So now I just want to take a moment to say that sometimes the press really does talk about numbers and it's really rather interesting. And I wanted to give you an example based on sensitivity and specificity. This was in the Washington Post, and it was an article on lie detectors. And here's how the story goes. 10,000 people take a lie detector test. And of these 10,000 people, 10 are spies, and the rest are honest folk. And it turns out there's some research, and these are numbers cited from this Post article, that about 1,600 people would fail the test, meaning that they would be told they're lying, that the test would indicate they're lying. And when they were honest. But 8 of the spies would also fail. And the other spies would pass, then the remaining people would pass the test. So I'm just running the numbers here. So we take away 8 of those 1,600 people to get the number of innocents, that's 1,592. And the total number of innocent people are 9,990. And those people are false positives. They tested positive for lying, but they weren't. Okay, so you can calculate the false positive rate is 16%, and subtract that from 100, and that's your sensitivity. So your sensitivity is 84%. It's a likelihood that a false test would test false. Okay. On the other hand, 8 out of 10 liars failed the test. So that's a specificity of 80%. Now we can just run the numbers with the 10,000 people taking the test. 10 are spies. The percentage of spies in the failed pool, meaning those people who failed the lie detector, is 8 out of 1,600, or 0.5%. So that makes it pretty hard to find the spies. I thought this was a very nice illustration of how you could have large sensitivity and specificity and yet still have a needle in a haystack kind of problem when you're trying to actually figure out who the spies are. So let me just tell you a little bit what we do at STATS. We have an assortment of activities like writing op-eds, speaking on radio shows, letters to the editor, interviewing on television. We do a little journalism ourselves, or a lot of journalism ourselves. We do a lot of advising journalists. We run workshops, provide educational materials, run a website with a lot of material on it, plus a blog. So if you're interested in this, you should go to stats.org and read about things that we're read some of the work we've done. We've also done some testifying to Congress, especially about pain medications. That's been a big issue. Polling the experts and publishing the results is also something we do. What do experts actually say? We've done a recent one on global warming that you can go there and read about. We also do the yearly Dubious Data Awards, which are a lot of fun. So Toxins for Tots is when Newsweek recommended throwing away toys. That was actually just before Christmas. Hurricane blowhards. After Katrina, predictions of hurricanes were everywhere, but it turned out there was a low point of the hurricanes following year. Girls Not as Wild as Hoped. This is one that comes up every year. You get these articles that these days girls are much wilder, they're having much more sex and doing a lot more drugs than they were 5 years ago. And actually, if you look at the data, girls are being much better behaved than they were when I was young. Miami Vice. U.S. media picked up a story claiming that Miami was more violent than Baghdad. As of 2006, it's at least 10 times safer. This is death rates. Kids are okay. You often get these stories about missing children. A story about how it has risen 44%. There has been, in fact, no increase. And the last one was how pornography causes brain damage. And it turns out the main expert was an automobile executive. So what is this all about? To me, it's all about living life better, putting our resources where they really belong, and taking them out of making people scared for no good reason. And so to that effect, I hope you've enjoyed this lecture.